from KCRW and KCRW.com. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. It's winter, and we're making chowder.
There's got to be clams, there's got to be cream, and there's got to be potatoes. That's what makes a chowder.
Jonathan Gault takes us to a new old favorite. Harold McGee answers your questions, plus how to dispose of oil. Just don't pour it down the drain. But first, let's check in with Laura Avery at the Santa Monica Farmers Market to see what's in season in Southern California this January 2011.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. It's a great new year here at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. We're meeting old friends and seeing people coming back after the holidays and all the rain we've had, sharing rain stories. As always, David Karp is here when he's in town, and he has an amazing discovery to share with us. It's something I don't even want to get too close to, but David, please describe to us what this vegetable is you're holding and tell us a little bit about its story.
This looks like a habanero pepper, but it's a deeper, darker red. It's lantern-shaped for those that are not familiar with habanero peppers, which were long considered the spiciest peppers in the world. In particular, there was one, that red Savina, that was the reigning champion when I wrote a cover story on this subject for Chili Pepper magazine some 15 years ago.
There was a Chili Pepper magazine?
Yeah, well, actually, something of the sort is being revived by the former editor, Chief Chili Honcho from New Mexico, Dave DeWitt, author of some 20 books on chilies. Anyway, this is the Butjolokia, B-H-U-T-J-O-L-O-K-I-A. That's two words.
Okay.
This is a pepper that's native to Assam, to northeastern India, and it's considered, or was considered until very recently, the hottest pepper in the world, which won it a considerable notoriety because that crowd that watches Jackass and once prides itself on being supremely macho is very likely to pull out one of these and say, I can eat more of these than you, and then people eat them and they fall on the floor crying.
Oh, jeez. Okay, well, I am not a hot pepper. I cannot do the hot pepper thing, but you can actually eat hot peppers. Do you find this personally to be the hottest pepper you ever ate?
It is the hottest pepper that I ever ate. Mm-hmm. A typical habanero is, well, let's put it this way. A jalapeno can be like 3,000 or 5,000 or 10,000 Scoville units. Scoville unit is how many times you have to dilute it and still taste the heat. So jalapeno, 3,000, 5,000, 10,000. Serrano, a little bit more. A habanero, like the standard orange habanero, maybe 300,000. Red Savina, maybe 500,000. And these were measured officially by a million, and the Guinness Book of World Records anointed them the hottest chili pepper in the world. A point arises, why do you need anything hotter than a habanero? It's mostly just for bragging rights, but also for industrial purposes. If you're manufacturing oleoresin containing capsaicin for military purposes or, say, for warding off bears or muggers, it's actually good, of course, to produce as many of these as much capsaicin as possible per pound of chili. Phil McGrath put in 500 plants in a greenhouse in Camarillo and sort of forgot about them for a while, and they started bearing just last month. He brought them just last week for the first time. He'll just have them for another couple of weeks.
Okay.
And he does intend to grow them next year, too.
So if you're a person who wants to take a bite out of these, what if you eat it and you find out you are literally paralyzed with pain? What are the antidotes?
That happened to me once, actually. I was in my apartment in New York 2 years ago when I ate what I thought was a dried jalapeno, a chipotle, and in fact it was a dried habanero, which is, of course, concentrates the flavor when they're dried. I collapsed as if I had been shot.
Yeah.
I was really writhing in pain, but I managed to drag myself somehow to the corner to a Korean grocery, and I bought some yogurt, and I consumed that, and that alleviated the pain.
Did it really?
Yeah.
Instantaneously?
The one thing that you don't want to do is just drink a lot of water, because that actually expands the stomach. It makes it more painful, and it actually potentiates the capsaicin. It just renders it stronger. So it's counterintuitive, but don't drink a lot of water.
Unbelievable. So Phil McGrath is the farmer who has these.
Yeah.
Well, David, this is so interesting. It looks like a cute little red pepper. Who would ever know?
Take a bite.
No. Thank you very much, but it looks very interesting, and I'm glad Phil grew these, and thank you for telling us about them.
You're very welcome. It's always fun.
With us right now at the market is Josiah Citron, who is the owner chef at Melisse and also at Lemon Moon. And Josiah, you're here every Wednesday. You're so fortunate to be so close to the market. Tell us a little bit about the cardoon, the one item that you wanted to pick out in particular today.
Yes, I always get really excited when I see something that you don't see very often, only a couple months a year. And cardoons are one of them, and Coleman Farms is growing them right now.
And tell us what they look like.
They're long. They look like a really big celery. More like a celery heart, though. Lighter color. Very light, pale color. So what we like to do, it's basically a lot like an artichoke. It has the same flavor as an artichoke. So what we do is we cook it like an artichoke in a bar eagle style, or with onions and carrots and white wine and stock.
You peel it?
You just kind of take a little bit of the strings off.
Okay.
And it tenderizes as you cook it. So you don't want to take too many, just the really thick strings. Take it down and then just kind of cut. You can either cut it up and cook it, or cook it in like big pieces. And the way we're going to serve it is with a poached duck egg with a little ragu of cardoons, black truffle, and a sunchoke puree. So it'll be kind of a wintry, truffly dish.
Yeah.
You know, maybe with some grated Parmesan cheese over it. If you just cook them, like, in the barrio. You always have to cook them in acid or they turn black.
Oh, okay. When you say cook it in a barrio, what is that?
Like a white wines, vegetables, cook it in an acidic broth.
Oh, acidic broth. Okay, yeah. All right, Josiah, as always, so great to see you here, and thanks for your support.
Thank you.
That was Josiah Citron. He's the owner chef at Malise and also owner of Lemon Moon. And he's here today to talk to us about cardoon, which is a wonderful vegetable grown by the Coleman Farm. Coleman is here at the Wednesday and Saturday Santa Monica markets. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
I've got Josiah Citron's method for cooking cardoons on the Good Food blog. Find it at kcrw.com/goodfood. The next time you're at the farmer's market, take a minute and talk to the farmers about what they do. Growing food's hard work, and just like we consider nutrition when buying food, think about those humans behind the label, too. You have a unique opportunity to actually interface with who grows your food. Don't waste it. Last year, I spoke to writer Barry Estabrook, who revealed to us some pretty horrific working conditions among tomato pickers in Immokalee, Florida. You can hear the full interview at kcrw.com/goodfood. Here's a clip. Is slavery too strong a word for the conditions faced by these workers?
Well, let's go through a few of the things. First of all, you don't get paid. Second of all, you're made to work, forced to work. Third of all, if you try to escape, you're threatened with death. And you're kept in chains at night.
Literal chains.
Literally shackled in chains. At night around a pole.
So let's talk about the circumstances of this. They're not paid. How can that happen?
Obviously, to even get involved in this type of work, you've got to be desperate. So it's a desperate person. It's often a person who's Hispanic from southern Mexico or Guatemala, for the most part, who certainly speaks little or no English and might not even speak very much Spanish. A lot of them speak Indian dialects. And they find themselves in the middle of Florida, and it starts innocently enough. Someone will offer them a ride, say, from Texas to Florida, and then when they get there, he'll say, well, you owe me $500, and you can work it off. And you never work it off. And so you're kept perpetually in this phony indebtedness.
Since then, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, an advocacy group, has been fighting for these workers' rights. Tom Philpott joins me today with an update. He's the senior food and agricultural writer for Grist. He says that this coalition's been fighting for higher tomato prices and better conditions for the tomato harvesters for years, and there's been a breakthrough.
What the CIIW did that was so innovative was that they worked with consumers, and really especially on college campuses, to organize these campaigns, and started these three-way negotiations where they would target a particular company and demand that that company pay an extra penny a pound for tomatoes and sort of shame the company and call boycotts. And the strategy was extremely successful. Taco Bell was the first one to cave in, then McDonald's, eventually Burger King, and they all these companies fought back really, really hard, but because of consumer pressure, mainly led by students, they caved in.
It really is an amazing story about how slow, constant pressure to yield a very small reward, one penny a pound, can ultimately be successful if the consumer is the lever.
That's right. Getting consumers involved was key, but there was a catch to the story, and that is that when these companies started to make these agreements, the growers really didn't like it. They were used to having all the power in negotiations with workers. they were used to having their way. And suddenly these workers are going above their heads and making these deals without them. And so what the growers did in about 2009 was they started to say, you know what, we're not going to pass that penny on. Because the companies pay the extra penny a pound to the grower, and the grower said, this is illegal. They had a specious legal reasoning that said it's illegal and we're not doing it. And they started to hold the penny.
Where did they hold the penny? Did they create special accounts?
They had to hold it in an escrow account because it would have been a real legal nightmare for them if they had pocketed it. And, you know, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars a year and even millions of dollars a year. And the CIW, with its incredible patience, continued making deals over the growers' heads and knowing that the penny a pound wasn't going to go directly to the workers yet. But they'd maintain pressure, and the breakthrough that you're talking about was that the growers have finally agreed under pressure to pass the extra penny a pound on.
Now, how much more does that penny a pound mean for an individual's increase in wages?
Well, it means about a 40% raise in their pay. And you're talking about the first raise that they've gotten in 25 years or something. And that is counting inflation. So these guys have not gotten an inflationary pay increase in all this time. And, you know, I was down there about a year and a half ago. There's just tomato fields for as far as the eye can see on all sides. And then in the town of Immokalee, there's what is essentially a little shanty town where hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of workers live during the growing season. And you would not believe the rents people pay. It is like Manhattan. I promise you, it's like Manhattan rents. Because what they'll do is they'll stuff 8 or 10 people into a tiny space and charge them each a couple hundred bucks a week. And when you add it up, it just becomes this astronomical rent.
So it's almost like the workers live at the behest of the company, almost like slavery.
Yeah, there's almost a company town mentality because they get these really, really low wages, and then a shocking percentage of that wage ends up going to the landlord. And the landlord and the growers are often in cahoots. Sometimes it's the same family. When conditions are like that, when workers are that disempowered and underpaid and living in conditions like that, it isn't that far of a descent to go into actual slavery. And in fact, several times over the past 10 years, growers there, not so much the growers, but the contractors, the work contractors, which is like one layer between the grower and the worker that the growers sort of play off. But contractors have been busted for slavery, for literally locking people up to trucks and not letting them leave. Oftentimes, the workers will arrive there in Immokalee owing thousands of dollars that they borrowed from some contractor that got them from Mexico. They're essentially indentured workers.
So has this raise for them, has it changed the way they're able to live their lives on a daily basis and made it even a little bit more comfortable?
Well, I think it's still a little early to tell what effect it's going to have because we haven't really had a sustained period when the workers were actually getting the raise. But I think that, you know, a 40% raise will at least allow people to send a little bit more money back home, which is what most of their goal is. And I think for the coalition, I think it lets them move on to things like housing. Then there's pesticides. I've talked to the CIW people about that, and they've been so focused on wages that they're not really even working on that yet. But tomatoes are an incredibly pesticide-intensive industry.
And I understand that they're also going to start focusing more intensely on supermarket chains.
Right. They've basically conquered fast food, and they've conquered some of the big sort of institutional kitchens. And I think now the big buyers left on their list are big supermarket chains like Publix. And down the road, from what I understand, Walmart, which is the biggest player in the market.
Read more about the Coalition of Immokalee Workers at kcrw.com/goodfood. I'll be back after this short break to talk chowder, or chowder, for all you New Englanders. Plus, Jonathan Gold's here with a restaurant for us to try. This week, he's got a new old favorite. Stay tuned. This is Good Food here on KCRW and KCRW.com. Welcome back to Good Food. I'm your host, Evan Kleiman. With this wintry weather, thoughts turn to soups and stews. Russ Parsons, food editor for the LA Times, is with me with some ideas for chowder.
There's so much variety. And one of the things that's really interesting about it, I mean, there's kind of like three ingredients that have to be there, right? There's got to be clams. There's got to be cream or, you know, some kind of milk. And there's got to be potatoes. That's what makes a chowder.
A chowder.
But you know what? In the original chowders, in the original American chowders, none of those things were there. The original American chowders were basically, it was a like salt pork. There would be a layer of sliced salt pork. There would be a layer of sliced onions and some mixed herbs in there. There would be a layer of sliced cod, because cod was like as cheap as potatoes are now. And then the thickener was soaked ship's biscuits, like those really, really dry, you know, like oyster crackers that you get now?
Yeah, but harder even than oyster crackers.
Oh, much, much, much harder. So in a weird way, it was almost like a New England version of that Italian soup, you know, where everything's boiled together with bread. But I think today our versions are probably less based on economy than those were and more based on flavor. And they're incredibly flexible. You know, I mean, you can use almost any kind of seafood that you want. You can use salmon. I mean, salmon, one of the few kinds of soups that you can actually use salmon constructively in, I think, is a chowder.
The fattiness of it works in the chowder.
And it works in a chowder. And actually, smoked salmon is really good in a chowder. If you get the hot smoked salmon so that it kind of comes apart in chunks, that's really nice as kind of an accent fish in a chowder. I think it'd be a little bit overpowering to do it the whole thing. You can use cod. Or you can use any of the West Coast, you know, any of the lean white fish. But of course, the classic is clam, and you know, there's really nothing that's easier to put together than a chowder when you just have clams and, you know, like especially those little Manila clams. But what's so funny is that people today kind of they rank their chowders by how thick they are.
Yeah, like the spoon sticks straight up.
Right, exactly. If you can stick your, like, you know, it's like sticking your spoon into earth or something like that. If it stands straight up, it's a good chowder. But I think really good chowders have a delicacy about them. And they're, you know, when chowders are that thickened, whether they're thickened with, you know, with ship's biscuits or whether they're thickened with flour, there's a tremendous masking of the flavors that go on. And so if you want those kinds of pure, delicate flavors, they ought to be brothy. And one of the really cool tricks that I've learned is that I learned it from an old James Beard recipe. And so I like potatoes in my chowders. What he does is he cooks the potatoes separately. When they're done, pulls the potatoes out, leaves the water behind, and then reduces the potato water over high heat to, you know, reduce it by about half. And then you add that to the chowder. And it works on a couple of levels. On the one level, there's a lot of free starch that's in that potato water that acts as a bit of a thickener. The other thing that happens, though, is that there's that potato flavor, you know, that slightly, not slightly earthy, there's an earthy flavor, but there's a slight bitterness that goes with a potato. You wouldn't notice it when you were tasting it by itself. You wouldn't say, oh, that's bitter. You know, oh, I like the bitterness in this. But when you taste them side by side with another chowder where it hasn't had that potato water added to it, there's a level of complexity that's different.
Do you like half and half?
Half and half would be about as far as I would go. I like half and half okay. I like whole milk with just enough cream added so that it gives you kind of the depth that you're looking for without actually masking the flavor of the fish. With clams, you want to cook the clams separately because you want to cook those over high heat. If you cook the clams with the cream in high heat, what you're going to do is get this awful separated mess. So just cook the clams in a skillet with a little bit of white wine or a little bit of water, whatever it is. High heat, lid on, boom, when they open up, they're done. Pour that into the cream mixture, you're done.
Wow, that sounds wonderful. So now how do we differentiate a stew from a chowder?
I think that's a Jesuitical question. And I am going to define it in my own way. And I think stews are chowders that are just a little bit lighter, a little bit simpler, and not quite as many ingredients. When I think about a seafood stew, I think about something like an oyster stew. You know, and just this Thanksgiving, for example, I had ordered 5 dozen. It was going to be the whole, you know, the centerpiece, the first course, the grand first course for the Thanksgiving dinner. 5 dozen Olympia oysters, and I was going to shuck them for people while we were. It was just, oh, it's going to be a great party. I got jars of oysters instead. They just shipped me the wrong order. So I'm stuck here. I have to have an appetizer ready in like an hour, and I've got 5 jars of oysters. So what am I going to do? Well, oyster stew. And oyster stew is even simpler than a clam chowder. You know, you fry out the bacon, add a little bit of onion, add a little bit of celery, add the half and half, and half and half in an oyster stew because it's, you know, it's really pure. I like a little bit of thyme in oyster stew. I mean, it just kind of brings out a little bit of the flavor that I'm looking for. And then add the oysters and cook them just until the lips begin to curl, you know, the outer ring, just until it begins to curl. Boom, you're done. Now, when you serve it, make sure you're serving it in like a hot bowl and add a tablespoon of butter to the bottom of each bowl. I mean, anything, that's going to make anything taste good, right?
Thank you so much.
Oh, it's always wonderful to talk to you.
Recipes for Russ's clam chowder and oyster stew are at kcrw.com/goodfood. And now a visit from Jonathan Gold, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food critic for the LA Weekly. He stops by every week with a restaurant recommendation. Today, he's taking us to a new old favorite. The Border Grill, which just opened in this Ciudad space in downtown LA. Border Grill is owned by chefs Susan Feniker and Mary Sue Milliken.
There's been a lot of attention over the last few years, especially about the new high-end or evolved Mexican cooking in this country. And a lot of names keep coming up. We don't have to mention them here, but they're famous chefs based in Chicago. Some are based in New York. Some are based in Austin. And in Los Angeles, I think we tend to forget just how good Border Grill is. And after 25 years, they were actually maybe 10 years ahead of the curve on this one.
At least.
The way that they're able to integrate the flavors of southern Mexico, you know, Veracruz, but, you know, especially the Yucatan at a time where those flavors were just not present in the LA vocabulary of flavors is nice. And it's nice to see that as the baseline has come higher and higher and higher, that Border Grill is still pretty much there at the top of the heap. It's hard, actually, to think of Border Grill as being 25 years old, but I think it is. They just had their anniversary party last week. I remember when the first one opened.
Yeah, me too.
And it's also hard to, you know, imagine that on the occasion of one's 25th anniversary, you would open a new branch of the restaurant. But there it is. It's kind of nice. I love Ciudad. I mean, I thought Ciudad was swell. But I also like having the Border Grill food, you know, right there in downtown without having to go to Santa Monica for it.
Did they change the room?
The room is funny. I mean, you know, it was sort of exquisitely done by Josh Schweitzer, you know, Mary Sue Milliken's husband. And when they were changing it over from Ciudad to Border Grill, they didn't really change any of the fixtures out of it. They still have those big marshmallow lamps and they still have the weird soffitting. But they got, you know, the painting team of Huntley and Muir, who have done all the other Border Grill restaurants, to come out, and they painted murals on it.
That must really be nice, actually.
It is. It's cool. Usually Border Grills are, I mean, the one in Las Vegas and the one in Santa Monica are big places. The murals are on the appropriately majestic size. Here, since the room is more intimate, the ceilings are lower, they're really in your face, those things. It's fun. It gives it a certain energy that must have been inherent in this room all along, but it seems just more so now.
So it's hard to imagine people who haven't been to a restaurant that's been around for 25 years, Border Grill, but give us an idea. Is it the same exact menu? What's the food?
Yeah, the menu is pretty much the same. So if you love, you know, Border Grill Panuchos, then they were really the first people to do Panuchos in town, which is now you see all over. It's atojito from the Yucatan, tortillas that are split and they're filled with black beans and they're fried and they're served with, you know, lettuce and crema and red onions and salsa, and they're just delicious.
Just delicious. There's a little turkey there too, I think.
Right.
Really, really good.
The last time I was there, I had the carnitas plate, which I hadn't had in a while. And they're pretty different from the other carnitas in town. I think they use a better quality pork than you see most places. But it's soft. It's not the crispy kind. It's the soft kind. And the dish is played in a way that there's a big interplay between, you know, the acids of the garnish of the onions and such and the meat itself. The pork really comes out in a certain way. They do a version of cochinita pibil. Always me and the pork. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but their cochinita pibil is delicious.
They do a really good one. And it's interesting to sort of like contrast the one that they have, which is fairly classic, though doesn't have the super strong banana leaf flavor that traditional ones do in the Yucatan. But it definitely has, you know, the chili soaking into the skin, as opposed to the version served a mile south at Rivera, where it's sous vide, and where it's almost like this pillow of cochinita pibil.
What's the cocktail menu like? It must be pretty great.
One would expect the cocktail menu would be good, and it really is. Though I will admit that I haven't like drunk my way through as much of it as I certainly intend to. But they still do the mojitos that they did at Ciudad.
Which is my favorite drink there.
You know, it's a toss-up between them and maybe Ciamara for having the best mojitos in town. And, you know, partisans of each are welcome to the drunken fist fights in a venue of their choice. you know, they still do the, you know, minty lime cooler, which is basically the mojito without the booze. And, of course, the vast panoply of Border Grill margaritas with really top-shelf tequilas.
Are they still serving that incredible Tres Leches cake?
They are. That Tres Leches cake is good.
Yeah, it's really good.
But I found a dessert that I can't believe that in, you know, the dozens of times I've been to Border Grills I've never had, which is a flan made with goat milk. It's a really nice goaty flavor. It doesn't take over, but it is there. Every molecule that ever screams goat at you. If I was going to get one dessert, I think it would be that one.
And then what about big plates, entrees?
The big plates are pretty much the big plates that you would have found at the other place. So you have, you know, the famous, you know, halibut that crusted in pepitas, the inside of pumpkin seeds and grilled. You have, you know, a rack of lamb with like all the flavors of like, I guess like a Puerto Rican sofrito. Somehow it's Mexican, but it definitely has that, you know, Caribbean flavor to it. There's, you know, their famous version of fish Veracruz style with the tomato sauce and the olives and the capers and chili relleno. If you've never had a Border Grill chili relleno, you should probably have one now.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Glad to be here.
Get the address for the Border Grill in downtown L.A. sent directly to your cell phone. Just text the words good food to 69866. Reply to the text, and then you can get a list of Jonathan Gold's recommended dishes. That's the words good food to 69866. You can also find all of his restaurant picks on the Good Food restaurant map. It's on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. If you look online for a photo of Jonathan Gold, you'll find only one that pretty clearly shows his likeness. It's the image taken when he celebrated his Pulitzer Prize win. 20 years ago, you'd be really hard-pressed to find any photographs of restaurant critics anywhere. Anonymity is considered crucial for their reviewing process. But as LA Times restaurant critic Irene Verbilla found out a couple of weeks ago, the internet has changed all of that. A restaurant owner posted her photo online after asking her to leave the restaurant. People are still buzzing about this breach on Twitter and Facebook. Jonathan Gold wrote a wonderful piece for the LA Weekly called Two Cheers for Anonymity. I've got a link to it at kcrw.com/goodfood. One of our listeners brought up a really interesting point when he asked what it's like for restaurant critics outside of the U.S. So I called my friend Ernie Wally, a food writer in Dublin.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
I'm great.
Good, good, good.
Well, I was wondering if you've heard about this outing of our restaurant reviewer for the L.A. Times.
I have indeed. Yes. In fact, somebody flagged it on my website within about 10 minutes of it happening.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, power of the internet.
Yeah. So tell me what you think. Do you think anonymity is important for a restaurant critic to be able to do an effective job?
No, I don't, personally. I think there are lots of other qualities that a restaurant critic should have that are much more important than anonymity. To an extent, obviously, because in Ireland we're operating in quite a small, cosy market, and particularly in Dublin. And the chances of any restaurant critic worth his salt being anonymous are pretty rare.
So you wouldn't get kicked out of a restaurant summarily?
Well, it's always possible. I happen to know one restaurant in Dublin where they have my photograph and the photographs of two other restaurant critics behind the till. And they have instructions, I think, not to let these people in. Now, I did manage to sneak in about 6 months ago and review one of them. And it wasn't exactly a very auspicious review, but I've not heard back, thank goodness.
Do you go back multiple times before you do a review, particularly if you know the review is going to be rough?
Reluctantly. Yes, I would do. It rather depends, because one of the things that I think far more important than anonymity is some sort of background and objectivity. I'm not saying that a restaurant critic should have run a catering establishment or a restaurant. I mean, I have, but I know an awful lot of good critics who haven't. But you should at least have the background. I mean, to take a very simple example, you really ought to be able to judge when a restaurant, let's say, when a good restaurant is having a bad night, or when something that happens is this is just a one-off. I think that for me is far more important than mere anonymity.
What else do you think is really important for a restaurant critic to have as ability or background?
Well, I think you have objectivity. You've got to have objectivity. I think you can't go in with any element of malice or bias. They've got to be able to write entertainingly. I mean that's so important. We are, to a very large degree, part of the entertainment industry. And I think readers. I mean, I've worked for publications where the editor has been absolutely cock-a-hoop if you come in and you've given some restaurant a hard time, and they go wow. Whereas if you praise some restaurant to skies, they're not really that bothered. But it's a bit like sort of bad news sells newspapers.
It's been so wonderful talking to you, Ernie.
Good to talk to you again. Take care. Bye.
Ernie Wally reviews restaurants for the Evening Herald and Dubliner magazine. You can read his hilarious writing at forkandcork.com. I've got a link to him on our website, too. I'll be back in 1 minute with Harold McGee. You ask the questions and he answers you. Next. This is Good Food here on KCRW and KCRW.com. I'm Evan Kleinman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Harold McGee, or Hal as his friends call him, is revered for the depth of knowledge he provides to the cooking experience. On Food and Cooking and The Curious Cook are Bibles to a lot of home cooks who use them over and over again as reference materials. His latest book is a little different. It's called Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and Recipes. Hal, we've done something a little different today. We sort of put out a call on Facebook to ask our listeners if they had questions for you.
Ah, okay. I'll do my best.
Now, this one deals with dry beans, and it comes from Adam Immerwar. He asks, is it true that adding acidic things, such as a tomato, to dry beans will, quote, freeze their cooking process? And what about salt? And then he goes on to ask also about beans. Is soaking really necessary and why? And can you elaborate on hot soak methods versus cold soak methods?
Mm-hmm. All right. Everything you always wanted to know about beans.
Exactly.
So let's begin with the acid. Acid will slow and may even prevent the softening of dry beans. And that's because the stuff in the cell walls that gets softened during the cooking process is stabilized in acid conditions and weakened in alkaline conditions. So if you cook from the beginning in an acidic liquid, you're essentially reinforcing the cell walls rather than dissolving them. And so they stay hard. The flip side to that is that if you cook the beans and you've gotten the texture you want and you don't want them to go from that point to mushy, then you can add the acidic ingredient at that stage, and that'll help stabilize that structure.
I had no idea. I love this. Okay, and then what about salt? Will salt make the cooking process last longer, or should we wait till the end?
Well, you do read in many cookbooks that salt toughens beans and prevents them from softening. And in fact, the truth is what you just said, that it slows the process down. And it's simply because it's an osmotic effect. The salt slows the penetration of water into the bean. And that, in fact, is the rate-determining step in the cooking process for beans. You're doing two different things. You're getting water into the bean, and you're heating the bean and softening it that way. And it takes a much longer time to get the water in than it takes to get the heat in. So that leads to yet another point about pre-soaking. If you pre-soak the beans so that you take care of the wetting process, the hydration process, which is not something you need to attend to. You can just put the beans in some water in a pot and leave them overnight, come back the next morning, and they'll take much less time to cook because you've taken care of the step that takes the longest.
Okay, so now Glenn Lindgren asks us about trichinosis in pork. Has it been eliminated in the United States, and is it safe to eat a rare pork chop?
Trichinosis has, for the most part, been eliminated from commercial pork in the United States. I haven't looked at the journal that reports on such things. The Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report is the name of that journal. And so I don't know whether in the last few years there have been any cases of trichinosis caused by commercial pork. But my guess is probably not. The last time I looked, the cases were being caused by informally raised hogs outside of the commercial pork system, and hunting. Turns out that bears and other wild animals can carry trichinosis and other parasites, and those constituted the cases that the CDC was aware of. So I would say at this point, if you're buying your pork from a reputable butcher, it's fine to have a rare pork steak or chop.
This next question comes to you from me and from one of our segment producers, Jillian Ferguson. We're really curious about invert sugars. What are they? And when and why is it preferable to use them in cooking? And are they naturally occurring, or are they an industrialized process from refined sugar?
Okay. So Invert is a term that comes from a measurement of the direction that a polarized beam of light is shifted when it goes through a solution of either regular table sugar, sucrose, or other sugars that that move in the inverse direction. So invert sugar is simply a kind of catch-all phrase for glucose and fructose, which are just different sugars from sucrose. And the reason they're valuable in cooking is that they prevent the crystallization of sucrose. When you have a very concentrated syrup of table sugar and you want to make a candy out of it, for example, or a caramel sauce or something like that, and you don't want big crystals, you don't want it to be grainy, then what you can do is add a little bit of glucose or fructose. And because those are also sugars, but not exactly the same as sucrose, they actually prevent the sucrose molecules from falling into a nice, orderly crystalline structure. So they keep the texture of the candy smooth.
Oh, so interesting. Okay, now we go on to a question from Diana Davis. Is it really true that some people have a genetic predisposition to hate the taste of Brussels sprouts?
Yes. It turns out that whenever we sense the flavor of a food, the taste or the smell, we're relying on receptors in our taste buds and in our nose to have that experience. And we have about 500 different receptors for tastes and smells, as far as we know. And those receptors are there or not there, depending on our genetic heritage. So different people have different permutations and combinations and numbers of those receptors, which means that all of us essentially experience the flavor of a given food slightly differently, and in some cases very differently from one another. That's a very important thing for chefs to be aware of and to understand. And in the case of Brussels sprouts, things in the cabbage family can taste very bitter to people who have a particular genetic background that gives them a large number of especially sensitive receptors for particular bitter compounds that you find in the cabbage family. So, and I've noticed this in my own family. When I make Brussels sprouts, I love them, and they don't taste bitter at all to me. That's probably because I just don't have that receptor. My daughter can't stand them, and she says it's because they're really bitter.
Okay, now here's another. Diana Davis has a lot of really good questions. This one is I think, really interesting, and I wonder about it too. She says, is there a way to make coffee taste as good as it smells when brewing? Love the smell, but the taste never seems to follow through. How is it that something that smells so good doesn't taste the same?
Excellent question, and really interesting. And this is something we've only known about for a few years. It was always a puzzle to me, slightly different issue, why it is that a really stinky cheese like an Epoisse or a Taleggio smells really strong, but then once it's in your mouth, it's kind of balanced and pleasant. So that's the positive side of it. It can, and the basic phenomenon is that things that we smell by drawing air in from around us is very different from drawing air from our mouth. So in one case, we're sampling our environment. In the other case, we're sampling something that we're actually eating. And it turns out, from studies that have only been done for a few years now, our brain processes those two different inputs differently. It uses a different set of pathways to take that information in and make sense of it. And so we're actually having a different experience of exactly the same molecules, partly because they're in our mouth, and simultaneously with experiencing those same aromas, we're also experiencing, in the case of coffee, bitterness, astringency, depending on whether you add sugar, maybe sugar as well. And it turns out that taste sensations often dampen our perception of aromas.
Thank you so much. This has been really fun.
Pleasure. Pleasure. Anytime, Evan.
I don't have time in today's show for all of your questions. There were so many. But you can find the rest of Hal's answers, including how to prevent a meringue from weeping, on the Good Food blog. Thanks to everybody who submitted questions for Hal McGee on my Facebook page. If you're one of the half a billion people on Facebook, I do hope you'll join me on my page. It's become a place for people to ask for advice and share ideas. I also give away cookbooks occasionally. I hope to see you there. Up next, exactly how you're supposed to dispose of fats and oils. Don't put them down the drain. Plus, Gustavo Arellano takes us on a personal journey in his hometown of Anaheim. That's next. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be right back. This is Good Food, and I'm your host, Evan Kleiman. Frequent listeners to this show know Gustavo Arellano for his Orange County restaurant reviews. He's the food editor for the OC Weekly and the author of the very popular Ask a Mexican column. He's also the author of Orange County, A Personal History. Today we're going with Gustavo to a donut shop at a strip mall in Anaheim. But as you'll hear, this isn't just any donut shop.
Hi, I'm Gustavo Arellano with Good Food, and I am here at Jack's Donut House in Anaheim. It's a nondescript donut house that I've been going to since I was 3 years old. And so over the past 30 years, this has been the weekend gathering place for men from El Cargadero, which is a small little village in the state of Zacatecas where my mom's from and where over 1,000 of us are here in Anaheim. So everyone's just shooting the breeze, and we're waiting for a class from Fullerton College to come and analyze us as a historical landmark of Orange County. I'm here with my dad, mi papi Lorenzo, or everyone knows him as Lencho. When we were small, myself and my sister, he'd bring us here. It's a shopping plaza here in Anaheim. What the men will do, they'll sit right next to the bushes, and they'll stay here for hours and hours. And they don't call it, though, the donut house. They call it la cafeteria, the cafeteria. ¿Por qué le dicen la cafeteria? What do you call it, the cafeteria?
Porque es cafeteria.
No es?
Bueno, cafetería y lugar de donas, pero así le nombramos la cafetería.
Y usted, my dad's been coming here for 30 years, almost since the beginning. What ended up happening then, my dad said that you had hundreds of men, young men, they were in their 20s at the time. Now they're all in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. So they came here not really knowing anything about life in this country. They're all just young men, and so they would use this as a weekend spot to just relax, just to talk to people, talk. And they all knew each other back in Mexico, back in El Cargadero. My dad's from a village right next to it called Homulquillo, but you would have all these men just kind of gather. Cada fin de semana, ¿verdad?
Todos los días hay gente aquí de allá de Zacatecas.
Every day, and then, for the past 30 years, men from El Cargadero, from Zacatecas, they've been gathering here. Sometimes you have five, sometimes you have two, sometimes you have 15 or 20. Everything around this area has changed except these men coming back again and again and again. And it's a joke amongst our generation of kids where there's a Facebook page for people from El Cargadero, and we say, you know you're from El Cargadero if your dad spends his Saturdays at La Cafeteria in Anaheim. And here's Professor Jerry Padilla from Fullerton College. How's it going, Professor?
Oh, it's going very good. We've been on a little tour. We went to Fullerton, went to the old Elephant Packing House Company. Then we came into Anaheim, went to the old Barrio La Conga, mm-hmm. and then over to La Fabrica. I showed them where the segregated school used to be. Then we talked about how Northgate Market came to be.
Northgate's a big Latino supermarket here in Orange County.
Yeah, and it was originally owned by a white family years ago. At the North Gate, which was the northern gate of the original square mile that is now the city of Anaheim, and the family sold it to Mr. Gonzalez, who then created Gonzalez's North Gate Market.
And now today you're here at Jack's Donuts house. Why?
We're here at Jack's Donuts because of the fact that, first of all, they have good food, good donuts and stuff, but Mr. Lorenzo Arellano comes here with his buddies and hangs out, and Gustavo also talks about it in his book.
Yeah, Professor Padilla is a professor of Chicano studies at Fullerton College, so he teaches a lot about the history of Mexican Orange County. And when he told me that he was taking his students to Jack's Donuts House, it's like such a meta moment for me. Like, I wrote about it in my book, which these students are holding, Orange County Personal History, which I only give it a couple of sentences, and yet to have all these people talk here, I don't know. It's humbling, but it's also kind of weird. Obviously, for me, Professor Padilla, this is a very personal story because I've been coming here since I was, 3 years old, and I've always known my dad go every weekend to La Cafeteria. But yourself as a professor, why do you bring your students here besides the fact that it's part of my book?
I like to come to the Donut House because, first of all, I've been coming here for several years. I've noticed over the years, the diversity of the people that come here to the donut shop. When I grew up in Anaheim, we didn't have the population coming from Gustavus's hometown. We just, your hometown, we didn't have it. We didn't have it. Well, I went to Anaheim High School before this great migration started from Central Mexico and Northern Mexico. When I was growing up here, all of us kids were American-born. We're all Chicanos, American-born. A lot of our parents were American-born, but our grandparents are the ones that were born in Mexico. So I grew up in a different world. I grew up in, World War II and into the 1950s. And I graduated from Anaheim High School in 62, and I know you graduated,
97. Class of 97 rolls.
Yeah, yeah.
So. Do you find it surprising that you do have now these immigrant hubs where the men would come to one particular area and then sort of relive their childhood here?
With my academic training and background, I'm well aware of this procedure, this process, and it can be documented all over Orange County among the Vietnamese, and different populations. But honestly, in coming to this particular place, I would just come in, stumble in the morning, get my coffee, talk to the guys, whatever. Well, we never talked about the fact that they were all coming from the same town. We just never got into it. And then I read the book and I go, wow, I never realized that.
So we were at Jack's Donuts House, and I have to eat the breakfast that I used to eat when I was a small kid here, which is Nestle Quick chocolate milk with massive, frosty, yummy cinnamon roll. I'm Gustavo Arellano with Good Food and Yum, Yum, Yum.
I've got photos of Gustavo and his father at Jack's Donut Shop on the Good Food blog. In the restaurant world, we dispose of our waste fats, oil, and grease in big drums that get taken away and turned into cosmetics. Yum. Or in grease traps under the ground that filter those fogs from wastewater. Grease traps can cost more than a nice car. But what do you do at home? If you're still flushing those fogs down the drain, listen up to Doug Walters. He's the senior environmental engineer for LA City's Bureau of Sanitation Wastewater Engineering Division. So describe what fogs are.
Fog is basically fats, oils, and grease. And in the homeowner's sense, it's the grease that comes from cooking of food. Oily substances and anything that, inside of your body, would potentially clog an artery, or in this case, your sewer.
So basically, we should think of the Los Angeles wastewater system as a giant organism, and we have to be careful not to clog its arteries. What happens to these fogs if we do pour them down the drain?
They tend to aggregate and cling to the outsides of the pipes. A lot of this is sometimes seen with older pipes that have different residues. It also depends on the makeup of the pipe, how old it is. A lot of pipes in our yards that come from our kitchens and our homes have roots in them. Roots come through the cracks in the pipes. And they're attracted to the moisture. So another good housekeeping effort is to keep roots away from pipes and using chemicals that can take care of roots, or, of course, some type of roto drilling of the roots. But the fog, the greases, and the oils connect inside the pipe and are attracted to those roots. And it really creates a problem and starts to clog, and you see some backup in your sink and faucets.
So if we're not supposed to put things down the drain, what do we do with it?
The best management practice that we encourage all businesses and homeowners to use are best management practices, which is basically to wipe your plates clean, wipe your all your cooking dishes of the oil and just throw that into the garbage can, basically, so that that waste would go ultimately to the landfill. So it's preventing it from going into your sink and thus clogging.
You know, it's interesting because most regular residential people don't know that a few years ago, the sanitation department in Los Angeles made restaurants take out all of their garbage disposals.
That's correct. Yes. Garbage disposals are a huge problem because it just dissipates the grease, breaks up the products, the food waste. And, you know, the concept of those many decades ago was to make the solid matter smaller so that it would flush down. But in this case, and many restaurants reluctantly have found and have thanked our inspectors later that by getting rid of those garbage disposals, there's a lot less opportunity for the waste to aggregate inside their sewers. And so we're seeing a lot of the problems dissipate by them throwing away the material through the solid waste stream and not having that into the sewers to begin with.
Is that going to happen eventually in homes? Will garbage disposals not be allowed?
That would be a good policy discussion. That's probably our policymakers and city council members have yet to discuss. I think right now we just rely on educating the public and letting them decide what's best. But I've even noticed in my own kitchen that when I put something like celery down the drain, that just is a recipe for disaster and a $100 plumbing bill. I found that there's certain types of vegetables that I'd prefer not to use my garbage disposal on. But occasionally on some things, the garbage disposal does seem to clear things up. But I'm much more conscientious after those plumbing bills of what I put down there and definitely try to reduce the grease.
Well, thank you so much, Doug.
You're so welcome. It's a pleasure.
All of the Department of Sanitation's instructions for disposing of fat oils and grease is at kcrw.com/goodfood. In fact, you can get information on all of today's guests there, too. You can subscribe to the podcast. You can listen to past episodes on iTunes or on our website and find pictures, videos, recipes throughout the week on the Good Food blog. Right now on the blog, check out Good Food producer Jillian Ferguson's photo of her mom's turkey held together by a safety pin. A really ingenious trick. Harriet Ells produced and edited today's show. Jillian Ferguson, Candace Moyer, and Laurel Garcia are our segment producers. Thanks to Ronnie Mickelson, Bob Carlson, Gary Messiha, and Candace Moyer. I'm Evan Kleiman. See you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.